Welcome to the Loopcast. Today we're going to be talking about North Korea, and I'm very happy to have Greg Scarlatti on the line, and he is the Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, otherwise known as HRNK, and he's going to be here to give us his advanced expertise on this country that a lot of the aspects of North Korea are sort of hidden behind a curtain to the rest of the world. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Mr. Scarlatti.
Chelsea, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you very much for the invitation to join your show.
And so, I mean, you have years of experience in North Korea studies and North Korea policy and so forth. And so why don't you just give us a brief overview of this country that a lot of us don't know a lot about here in the West because it's so guarded and so private, I guess you could say.
North Korea was established after the liberation of Korea from 40 years of Japanese occupation in 1945. The northern half of the Korean Peninsula was fell under Soviet control. The southern part of the Korean Peninsula was under U.S. control after the end of the Korean War. Free elections were organized in South Korea, not in North Korea. This eventually resulted in de facto separation of the two Koreas. And then with significant Soviet and Chinese assistance, on June the 25th, 1950, North Korea attacked South Korea. The Korean War has never ended technically. There is an armistice put in place on the 27th of July, 1953. Millions of casualties. And after this great cataclysm, the Korean War, the two Koreas have followed a very different path. South Korea today is certainly one of the world's economic powerhouses and also a role model as a liberal democracy, a role model for others in the Northeast Asia region and beyond. Unfortunately, North Korea has continued to remain pretty much a black hole on the map of Northeast Asia, while others have benefited from decades of prosperity in the same region. North Korea has continued to be a dictatorship for more than 60 years now, a dictatorship ruled by the Kim family. This is a unique case of a country where two hereditary transmissions of power were performed, one from grandfather to father, one from father to son, so from Kim Il-sung, the founder of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, to Kim Jong-il in 1994 when Kim Il-sung died, and then again from Kim Jong-il to the current leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, in December 2011, when he died. North Korea was a communist dictatorship for decades. At this stage, under the leadership of Kim Jong-un, North Korea's the fundamental strategic objective of the North Korean regime continues to be regime preservation at any cost. Although North Korea is a party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, the Genocide Convention, the Women's Convention, the Children's Convention, although North Korea is bound by the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as a UN member state, pretty much each and every conceivable human right is violated in North Korea. North Korea continues to run a political prison camp system where about 120,000 political prisoners are being kept, imprisoned, oftentimes up to three generations of the same family. This is a country where as many as 3 million people died of starvation in the 1990s while the North Korean regime was developing nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and purchasing jet fighters from Central Asian republics.
And so looking at this idea that you mentioned earlier of the two Koreas, I mean, you have North Korea that you just described, and it's quite unbelievable that there are still countries that have such a horrible human rights abuses. I mean, of course, we hear about human rights abuses in many countries, but the numbers and figures that you mentioned during the nuclear project are just stunning. And then you have their next door neighbor, South Korea, that, as you said, it's this bustling, modernized country that's, you know, being quite progressive in this day and age. I mean, how do these two Koreas coincide with sharing borders? I mean, we hear about people trying to cross the border from North Korea into the South, and so forth. I mean, let's look at this idea of the two Koreas and what that means for the region.
What this means for the region is that North Korea has continued to exist as pretty much as an anomaly. After all, communism in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union collapsed a quarter of a century ago in 1989. And many had predicted that when communism collapsed in Eastern Europe in 1989, North Korea's turn was next. Unfortunately, that was not the case, and the Kim regime managed to survive the disappearance of its communist allies. The two Koreas continue to be separated by the DMZ and the 38th parallel. The presence of North Korea and the continued existence of the Kim regime in North Korea has continued to pose grave challenges to peace and security in the Northeast Asian region and beyond. North Korea is a country that has continued to develop a long-range ballistic missile program and a nuclear weapons program with the ultimate goal of achieving capabilities that would enable it to mount a nuclear warhead on a long-range ballistic missile capable of reaching the continental United States. So North Korea has continued to pose grave challenges to peace and security in the region through the development of the nuclear and ballistic missile program, and also through the human rights violations that have continued to happen in North Korea, egregious human rights violations. And now, after the release of the report by the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korean Human Rights, we know full well that many of the atrocious, the egregious human rights violations committed in North Korea that continue to be committed amount to crimes against humanity. On the other hand, South Korea has undergone astounding development. We are all familiar with the term that the miracle on the River Han. South Korea achieved astounding economic development over a very short period of time, about 30 years or so. North Korea used to be a recipient of international humanitarian assistance, international development assistance, international security. Now South Korea has become a fully responsible member of the international community, a middle power, and a provider of humanitarian and development assistance all over the developing world, also a provider of international security through peacekeeping operations. South Korea is also a quite unique case of a country that benefited from the good and hard work of U.S. Peace Corps volunteers. Now, South Korea is deploying its own Peace Corps called Friends of Korea to various locations worldwide. So two very different countries, no doubt the same people, the same nation. After all Koreans live together under one political system, speaking the same language, sharing the same culture for one millennium. 1,000 years before the two Koreas were separated after 1945.
Wow, it's so interesting. I mean, Korea is not my region of expertise, so what you're telling me, I'm learning so much myself from the discussion so far. So let's look at the Kim regime, because basically you have this family that's just continued their ruling dictatorship, whatever you want to call it, through all these different decades. And let's look at this Kim regime and how it's changed North Korea as a country.
Certainly, as stated earlier, while there may have been some cosmetic changes under the current regime of Kim Jong-un, the fundamental strategic objectives of the Kim regime have remained the same. As stated earlier, the first fundamental strategic objective of the Kim regime is its own self-preservation. The second fundamental strategic objective of the Kim regime, as funny as that might sound, given that South Korea is such a prosperous and developed country, that second objective is the reunification of the Korean Peninsula under the Kim regime. The third fundamental strategic objective of the Kim regime is to drive a wedge between the United States and Korea to basically break up the U.S.-South Korea alliance. The United States and the Republic of Korea, South Korea, are staunch friends, allies, and partners. And it is very important to remember that this friendship, partnership, and alliance with the United States has provided South Korea with the security umbrella needed to achieve this astounding economic development. During the days of South Korea's accelerated development, of course, the U.S. markets were wide open to South Korean products, and the United States also was quite indulgent when it came to South Korea, maybe in the early days somehow protecting some of its nascent industry. So North Korea, the North Korean regime, understands how important the U.S.-South Korea alliance is to maintaining a peaceful, prosperous, liberal, democratic South Korea. Finally, the fourth fundamental objective of the Kim regime is to acquire and maintain international relevance by continuing to develop its ballistic nuclear missile and nuclear program. With absolutely no disrespect meant to Madagascar, that the size of the North Korean economy is comparable to that of Madagascar, the Kim regime knows full well that if it were not for its ballistic missile and nuclear development, possibly the international community wouldn't really talk about North Korea that much. And certainly that is very unfortunate from a viewpoint of somebody dealing with North Korean human rights on a daily basis, as I do. How has the Kim regime changed North Korea was your excellent question. Koreans are extraordinarily industrious people. South Koreans have managed to turn South Korea from one of the world's poorest nations into a true economic powerhouse. And certainly in this day and age, the cars that Hyundai and Kia make, or the electronics and flat-screen TVs and cell phones that Samsung and LG make, are well-known all over the world. Koreans are extraordinarily talented, hard-working, industrious people. One of my favorite stories is the story of ethnic Koreans deported from the Russian Far East immediately after the end of World War I. This happened in the midst of the great population swaps within the Soviet Union. They were accused of being Japanese spies because they looked Oriental, which is absolutely ridiculous, of course. So anyway, numerous Koreans, tens of thousands and tens of thousands, were just put on trains and dropped off in the middle of nowhere. in Central Asia, Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. Many of them died. The survivors dug holes in the ground. They lived off the land, and they ended up being one of the most prosperous communities in Central Asia, and continue to be so to this day. If they're only allowed to look after themselves to fulfill their potential, Koreans will never starve. The North Korean regime has not allowed the people of North Korea to do that. This is a country where the people of North Korea still suffer from malnutrition, nutritional deficiencies. This is a country that was affected by a great famine in the 1990s. Anywhere between 600,000 and 3 million people died in that famine. And all of this is being done just so that the Kim family regime can maintain its grip on power. Of course, you hear foreign travelers who go to the capital city of North Korea, to Pyongyang, and say that, well, you know, wait a minute, this doesn't look like a poor city. Things look pretty normal. There are cars. We see cell phones. Well, this is where the elites of North Korea live. The situation outside Pyongyang is very different, and life in Pyongyang as well, quite frankly, is not that great either. But anyway, one may compare the Kim family regime to a medieval overlord living up the hill or up the mountain inside the castle. Of course, the overlord doesn't want the commoners to die because they produce some value for the ruler. But if he has to sacrifice them by the millions in order to maintain his own grip on power, he will do it. And this is what the Kim regime has done for more than 60 years now.
So on that point, I think this is the perfect time to talk about the human rights issues pertaining to North Korea. And as you mentioned earlier in the talk, in February, the UN Commission Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea published a 400-page report, which basically documented widespread torture and human rights abuses, starvation, work camps, and so forth. And they basically called for urgent action and even asked for a referral to the International Criminal Courts concerning this and maybe prosecution for these human rights abuses. So why don't we look at this and let's talk about the main points of human rights abuses in North Korea. I know that there are many, but let's look at some of the main points on this
topic. Certainly, the most egregious human rights violations in North Korea are happening inside North Korea's political prison camps. In this day and age, March 2014, North Korea is still running a political prison camp system. About 120,000 people are held at these camps. They're subjected to relentless forced labor, induced malnutrition, torture, executions. Oftentimes, three generations of the same family are sent to the camps pursuant to a system of guilt by association called Yeonja-je in Korean language. It's a system of feudal extraction. In old feudal Korea, those perceived as having committed an offense against the ruler were punished up to three generations of the same family. Who are those who are sent to the camps? They are the perceived wrong thinkers, wrongdoers, those who are perceived as having engaged in the wrong associations. For example, somebody who speaks up against the regime will be sent to the camps or worse. Of course, somebody who is seen mistreating a photo of the great or dear leader. Somebody who rolls up his tobacco in a newspaper containing a photo of Kim Il-sung or Kim Jong-il or Kim Jong-un, if he's reported to the authorities, will end up being sent to a political prison camp. Pyongyang, the capital city of North Korea, used to be the center of the Korean Presbyterian Church. It used to be dubbed the Jerusalem of the East. Those with religious beliefs, Christians in particular, have been purged and exterminated with extreme prejudice in North Korea, beginning in the early days of the regime of Kim Il-sung. Those who are still associated with Christians, or those who are suspected of being Christians, are sent to the camps. Those with associations to South Korea, those with associations to the old Japanese Imperial Administration and their offspring, they're sent to the camps. Goodness, being in the wrong place at the wrong time when communism fell in Eastern.
Hi, and we're back. We had a minor technical difficulty with the recording device, but we're going to continue on from where we were talking about the North Korean work camps. So I'm going to pass it on to Mr. Scarlatti again and let you continue on with what you're talking about, these horrendous conditions that the people of North Korea are put through and the families that are put into camps and the reasons why.
It is almost impossible to understand how political prison camps can still exist in this day and age, March 2014. There are about 120,000 political prisoners being held in North Korea's hidden gulag, in North Korea's political prison camp system. Conditions are so atrocious that comparisons have been drawn with the Nazi death camps, the Nazi extermination camps, and the Soviet gulag. The prisoners are subjected to relentless forced labor, induced malnutrition, beatings, torture, executions. Oftentimes, three generations of the same family are imprisoned in the camps together with a perceived offender pursuant to a system of guilt by association called Yeonja-Jae Korean. This is a system of feudal extraction in old feudal Korea. If one was perceived as having offended the sovereign ruler, then up to three generations of the respective family would be punished together with the perceived offender. Who is sent to the camps? Those who are perceived to be wrongdoers, wrongthinkers, those who are perceived as having engaged in the wrong associations, or perceived as being of the wrong family background, are sent to camps. For example, those who may have been associated with the Japanese Imperial Administration during the period 1905-1945, the Japanese Imperial Occupation period, those who may have associations with South Korea, those whose relatives have defected to South Korea, those of religious beliefs. Before the Kim regime took over, before the communists took over in North Korea, Pyongyang used to be dubbed, Pyongyang, the capital city of North Korea, used to be known as the Jerusalem of the Far East, because Pyongyang was the center of Korean Presbyterian Christianity. Religion, but Christianity in particular, has been purged and exterminated with extreme prejudice in North Korea. Those who are thought to be Christians, or those who are thought to have an association with Christians, are sent to the camps and purged with extreme prejudice. Now, certainly, if one speaks up against the regime, that's almost certain to have him sent to a political prison camp once again, oftentimes together with three generations of the same family, but also treating, for example, the photo of the great or dear leader with disrespect might land one in a political prison camp. North Korean defectors have told us on numerous occasions that, for example, cigarette rolling paper is not easily found in North Korea, so they use newspapers. If one rolls up a cigarette in a newspaper containing the photo of Kim Jong-il, Kim Il-sung, or Kim Jong-un, that might land him or her in a political prison camp. Those who happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. In 1989, there were North Korean students in Eastern Europe. They were witnesses to the collapse of communist regimes, communist dictatorships in Eastern Europe. They were recalled by North Korea and put through a re-education process in re-education camps. Even an orthodox Marxist may end up in a political prison camp in North Korea if that orthodox Marxist realizes and speaks about the fact that Marxism, orthodox Marxism, has absolutely nothing to do with hereditary succession from grandfather to father, from father to grandson. Very important aspect about North Korea's political prison camps is that they're not part of any judicial process. There is no semblance of a judicial process. What we hear from survivors, from former prisoners, or even from former guards who have managed to escape to South Korea is that the overwhelming majority of the prisoners do not know why they are there. They're simply taken away in the middle of the night. So when we talk about North Korea's political prison camps, we're talking about these facilities where perceived political offenders are sent. Most of them don't know why they're there. There are other types of detention facilities in North Korea as well, the so-called Kyohwaso or re-education centers. Some common criminals are sent to these facilities, but sometimes political prisoners as well. Once again, when we talk about the 120,000 people held in the political prison camps, we talk about the Kwaliso in Korean, which means a management place. We're talking about the political prison camps. So the camps constitute an egregious human rights violation. As you said, Chelsea, the UN Commission of Inquiry that has been in existence for about a year now and will complete its mandate on the 31st of March of this year has conducted extensive and thorough research, interviews with defectors at public hearings in Seoul, Tokyo, London, and Washington, D.C. The Commission of Inquiry has found that many of these egregious human rights violations happening inside North Korea's political prison camps amount to crimes against humanity. We have learned about unspeakable violence conducted against women and children in particular. For example, in the case of women arrested and forcibly returned from China, in cases where they became pregnant with Chinese men, we've had very credible reports of infanticide, forced abortions, sexual violence. These are extraordinarily hard issues that we are dealing with. Through our research, we use satellite imagery analysis to locate these facilities. We know where they are. We know what the structures inside the camps are. We cross-check this evidence with former prisoners, guards, or former officials who used to run the camps. Now we have a report by a commission of the United Nations, a commission established by consensus by the UN Human Rights Council that has found that crimes against humanity have been committed and are being committed at these camps. The North Korean regime continues to adamantly deny the existence of these political prison camps. North Korea is also a country that has a system of social classification, or should I say social discrimination, based on one's degree of loyalty to the regime. North Koreans are classified into three social categories and over 50 social subcategories based on their degree of loyalty to the regime. The names are frightening. There's a core class, 20 to 25% of the population, those most trusted by the regime. At the core of the core class, there are those who are descendants of the partisans who fought along Kim Il-sung during his days of fighting against the Japanese in Manchuria. There is a wavering class of about 40 to 60% of the population. These are those who are, well, not exactly to be fully trusted, but not to be put in a political prison camp either. And then there is the so-called hostile class. Those were perceived as enemies of the regime, enemy of the state. Many of them end up in those political prison camps.
And so, looking at these class systems that they have in North Korea, and then you mentioned different cases that could put you in a camp, and you mentioned the newspaper with the picture of, depending on what time frame you're living in Korea, the leader at the time, and that potentially rolling a cigarette with his picture could be basis for putting you in a work camp. So, I mean, with these different classes in North Korea and these points of getting put into a camp, is it very much of a, I guess, I don't know if this would be the right term, but a spy society? Are people just so afraid that they will turn you in, or is it just so watched by the regime's people? I mean, how does this get out? Are people telling on each other so that they get into a better class of a trusted class in Korean society? Or how does that work exactly?
That is a key point. And one question that I often hear is, how has this regime managed to survive the collapse of other communist regimes by a quarter century? The relentless coercion, control, surveillance, and punishment exercised by the North Korean political police, by its internal security agencies, has ensured that the regime has stayed in power. A comparison that I like to make is that to Romania, the one Eastern European country that came closest to North Korea in terms of the regime paranoia and the surveillance conducted by the internal political police. Romania's population in 1989 was 23 million people. North Korea's population today is 24 million people. Romania's notorious secret police, the Securitate, had 14,000 agents, 1-4. North Korea's three internal intelligence agencies have 270,000 agents. The State Security Department has 50,000. The Military Security Command has 10,000. And the Ministry of Public Security, which is a more or less quasi-police force, it also acts as a political police, 210,000. In communist Romania, the internal security service had 500,000 informers, which is a fairly significant number for a population of 23 million. In North Korea today, a country with a population of 24 million people, each and every family has to participate in a neighborhood watch system called Imminban, 20 groups of 20 to 40 families. Each and every person has to report on others. There are weekly meetings of the Imminban. Everyone has to stand up and engage in a session of self-criticism, confess to others, tell them about the things that he or she has done wrong, the mistakes made during the past week. Then the respective person has to pick on somebody in the room and criticize them for the mistakes they have made during the previous week. And then somebody else stands up and criticizes the person who has just taken the floor. So it is not that North Koreans are evil. They're just people like you and me, like all of us, but they're simply afraid. What happens if I was in a room and somebody said something that might be perceived as wrong? What happens if I don't report? Then somebody else might report. Then they will know that I was in the room and then I'll be in trouble. So I better go and report right now. For that reason, because of this relentless coercion, control, surveillance, and punishment exercised by North Korea's internal security agencies, their agents, and their informers, the degree of social cohesion in North Korea is very low. It's very difficult for groups of people to get together and discuss. And I'm not even talking about politics here. It's difficult to get together and discuss sports. And for that reason, because the degree of social cohesion is so low, we haven't yet seen a major uprising in North Korea. And that is one of the reasons why the regime is still in place today.
Sounds like a complete cycle of fear from the way you're describing it. There's eyes everywhere. And as you said, if you don't stand up and tell someone, it's going to affect your family, yourself, your loved ones. It's quite unbelievable. Going back to the UN Commission Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea, the report, this Monday at the Human Rights Council, China's representative called this report a divorce from reality, which I thought was quite interesting. And I mean, this sort of indicates that China, which is a permanent member of the Security Council, could potentially block attempts to refer North Korea to the ICC. And on this point, what is the relationship between China and North Korea? China seems to be standing up for North Korea when looking at that statement of a divorce from reality on this UN inquiry report.
I was in the room, by the way, in Geneva on the 17th of Monday. I was there.
Bravo, then you're the perfect person to ask.
Well, this was no surprise. We have to remember that China is an aspiring superpower that has helped establish and maintain the Kim family regime for the past 60 years. China is a party to the 1951 UN Refugee Convention. However, it continues to forcibly repatriate North Korean refugees, claiming that they're not political refugees, but illegal economic migrants. We don't even need to go to the political argument here and say that the main cause for North Korea's economic ruin is not purely economic, but the regime's refusal to open up, to reform North Korea's economy. The fundamental argument here is that pursuant to the 1951 convention, if somebody has crossed an international border and upon return to one's country, he or she faces conditions of danger, then that person automatically qualifies as refugié sur place, refugee on site, and should be granted access to the process leading to acquiring political refugee status. China refuses to do that. And in Geneva on Monday, the 17th of March, in China's response, again, the Chinese representative claimed that these North Korean refugees, these North Korean political refugees are illegal economic migrants. Now, that is a huge issue. Many of these refugees, if returned to North Korea, especially if they have come across South Korean nationals or Christian missionaries along the road of defections, they will be in trouble. They will be sent to the camps. They will be tortured. Some of them will be killed. Once again, women who became pregnant with Chinese men along the road of defection, again, they will be in grave danger, subjected to forced abortion, sexual violence, torture, infanticide. Why does China maintain this position? Because China is all about stability. And China fears any course of events that, from his viewpoint, might jeopardize stability in the region. Arguments have made that there is a significant Korean minority in the border areas on the Chinese side of the border. The China fears that those numbers might go up. Of course, minorities are China's Achilles heel. If they're having such a huge issue with the Uyghur minority, just imagine the Koreans, this might trigger a domino effect. I don't buy into that, quite frankly. If China fears that higher number of North Koreans will end up in those border areas, the best way to ensure that they don't settle down in those border areas is to grant them access to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, grant them access to gaining asylum in South Korea and other third countries. They will not stay there in China. Fundamental. The reason why China is not helping is that to China, North Korea continues to be a satellite state, a buffer zone, a bargaining chip, a thorn in the side of the United States. And aspiring superpowers at the height of their prowess in modern and contemporary times, such as China, do not give up a satellite state just like that. The Chinese were unhappy when the young leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, had his uncle, Chang Song-taek, executed in December of last year. Chang Song-taek was the main point person in relations with China. He had friends, he had business partners with China. They were extraordinarily unhappy with his execution, but at the same time, this incident was not enough to persuade China to modify its fundamental strategic stance on North Korea. So at a UN Human Rights Council meeting, China spoke again about the North Korean refugees claiming that they're illegal economic migrants. China, in addition to other countries, Cuba, Belarus, Iran, Syria, Vietnam, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, Laos and Myanmar, spoke against country-specific special procedures or mandates, such as the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, created to address a specific country. So these countries' representatives claimed that such special procedures or mandates are counterproductive. However, one point that I would like to make is that none of these countries came to the defense of the North Koreans. None of them denied that these human rights violations, these crimes against humanity, were happening in North Korea. So what we have seen for the past few years is that in the UN General Assembly, there have been fewer abstentions. There have been fewer votes against resolutions on North Korean human rights. At the UN Human Rights Council, when this UN Commission of Inquiry was established on the 21st of March 2013, it was established by consensus with no vote by all 47 member states of the UN Human Rights Council. I would say that while some countries, some usual suspects within the non-aligned movement still have their reservations and dissenting opinions regarding this mandate, this country-specific mandate in particular. Everybody understands that these human rights violations happening in North Korea, and everybody understands that it would do tremendous damage to one country's political capital and image to unconditionally support this regime that has committed crimes against humanity. I think that we need to persuade China as well that there is a significant political price associated with unconditionally supporting an egregious human rights violator that has committed crimes against humanity and that is unwilling to admit that these violations are happening, unwilling to change, unwilling to reform, unwilling to correct the current situation.
Very much so. And then staying on the subject of China and North Korea, you alluded to earlier, like way at the starting of the talk, sore relations between Japan and North Korea because of the history between the two countries. And today, March 21st, it was announced that a deal was brokered in China for North Korea and Japan to hold government-to-government talks for the first time since 2012, which is, I would think, an important development. What might this mean for relations between North Korea, Japan, and even China? Because once again, China's sort of involved in brokering this deal.
North Koreans have been historically very good, very skillful when it came to playing one great power against another. During the days of the Cold War, Kim Il-sung very skillfully played the Soviets against the Chinese. Under the current circumstances, the North Korean regime is heavily dependent on the Chinese. While the Chinese may have helped broker this deal, they're certainly trying to diversify a little bit. These efforts are doomed to fail. For a certain reason. As you have mentioned, certainly historically relations are sore because of the legacy of the Japanese occupation period, but there is another very important issue. North Korea, since the days of the Korean War, North Korea began engaging in the practice of abducting South Korean nationals and then nationals of Japan and other third countries. Why? To have them teach foreign languages and cultures to North Korean intelligence agents, in some cases to assume their identities as they dispatch these agents on overseas missions. In 1987, the North Koreans bombed South Korean Cal Flight 858. More than 100 people died right before the Seoul Olympics in 1988. The two North Korean agents who planted the bomb on the plane posed as Japanese nationals, and one of them actually survived. A woman who ended up in South Korea was sentenced to death. His sentence was commuted, ended up becoming a celebrity, published a book, married her North Korean bodyguard. She testified that she had been trained by Japanese nationals abducted by the North Koreans. The current Abe government in Japan has been very big. Prime Minister Abe, this issue of abductions by North Korea has been very important. The position of minister in Japan has been elevated to a cabinet position. The current minister, Furuya, holds a cabinet position as minister for abductions. There is a breakthrough. So, in other words, South Korea, Japanese nationals have been taken by the Japanese. Their friends and families want to know their whereabouts. They don't know where they are. In 2002, while the Japanese Prime Minister was visiting North Korea, Kim Jong-il, then leader of North Korea, admitted that some rogue elements in North Korea had abducted Japanese nationals. So he admitted that 13 Japanese nationals had been taken by North Korea. The North Koreans claimed that 8 were dead, 5 were allowed to return to Japan. The remains of the dead were returned to Japan. It turns out that DNA testing proved that the remains did not belong to the respective abductees. Who does that? So basically, the issue of abductions by North Korea, the abduction of Japanese nationals by North Korea, is going to loom large. This has been a very important issue for the Abe cabinet in Japan. And only a few days ago, the parents of Megumi Yokota, this was a young girl, age 13, abducted by the Japanese. Abducted by the North Korean. She was taken to North Korea, married a South Korean abductee. They had a daughter. Her name is a household name in Japan and other countries as a symbol of this terrible issue of abduction by the North Koreans. Only a few days ago, her parents were allowed to meet their granddaughter in Mongolia. So the expectation on the North Korean side is certainly that, as it was in 2002, that Japanese aid, investment, trade might follow discussions with Japan. The expectation on the Japanese side is that any type of contact would bring full disclosure to this issue of abductions. Now, there are more than 20 Japanese who have, well, the Japanese government has acknowledged that more than 20 Japanese nationals have been taken by the North Koreans. However, according to groups, NGOs in Japan, groups comprising family members, human rights activists and others, the numbers are in the hundreds. Now, unless North Korea brings full disclosure to this issue of the abduction of Japanese and other nationals by North Korea, there is no future in any contacts between North Korea and Japan. Japan is a liberal democracy. Any Japanese government has to respond to the demands of Japanese civil society and civil society NGOs. Under the current arrangement, under the current regime of Kim Jong-un, full disclosure, full transparency is impossible. This will not go anywhere.
Well, then looking at relationships with North Korea, let's look at the relationship between North Korea and the U.S., which I know is a loaded topic, and I know we only have so much time with you, but maybe we could talk about that briefly. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, North Korea is a nuclear country, which any country that has nuclear weapons is always much more thought of and much more, there's a lot of leeway that's given to them because of that. So let's look at these two aspects. So U.S., North Korea, and North Korea as a nuclear country.
I think that the fundamental diplomatic problem that the North Koreans have is that their international credibility is close to zero. North Korea joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty in the late 1980s. Then in 1987, in 1993, they decided to pull out of the NPT. North Korea was developing nuclear weapons, a plutonium-based nuclear program. Then we put in place the so-called Geneva Agreed Framework of 1994 that was to disperse energy assistance to North Korea in exchange for their doing away with their nuclear program. They decided to pull out of the Geneva Agreed Framework. Later on, they joined the six-party talks. Then they decided to pull out of the six-party talks. On February the 29th, as recently as February the 29th, 2012, the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea Policy, Ambassador Glyn Davis, met in Beijing with North Korean First Vice Foreign Minister Kim Kye-gwan, and they came up with what we came to know as the Leap Day Agreement. The United States agreed to resume some level of assistance in exchange for North Korea's placing a moratorium on their ballistic missile tests and their nuclear tests, their nuclear program. 2.5 weeks after the Leap Day Agreement, they announced that they would proceed with a ballistic missile launch. Of course, they called it a satellite launch on the 13th of April, 2012, with 2 days to go till the centennial anniversary of Kim Il-sung's birthday. So they broke that agreement as well. As you know, the North Koreans have taken several U.S. citizens. Currently, they're still holding a U.S. citizen hostage, Kenneth Bae, who was there on a tour. They claimed that he was distributing religious material and engaging in anti-state activities. Anyway, to make a long story short, the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korean Human Rights, Ambassador Robert King, has been invited to North Korea twice, presumably to negotiate, to discuss the release of Kenneth Bae. They rescinded the invitation on both occasions on the day before Ambassador King's scheduled visit. So the fundamental problem in contacts with the North Koreans is that their international credibility is zero. They have breached pretty much each and every promise and engagement they have made. Also, the problem is that we have been focused exclusively on North Korea's nuclear program and on North Korea's ballistic missile program. What is clear to the overwhelming majority of North Korea experts here and elsewhere, not to all of them, is that the Kim regime will never, ever give up its nuclear weapons. Certainly, U.S.-North Korea contacts have not only been limited to discussions aiming to ensure the complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear during after the Great Famine of the 1990s, the United States disbursed a significant amount of humanitarian assistance. Food assistance and energy assistance to North Korea combined has amounted to $1.2 billion, which is not an insignificant amount. There are no current bilateral U.S. programs in North Korea. The last time we saw such a program was a USAID food assistance program in 2008-2009 that came to an end because the North Koreans refused to comply with the terms of reference, with the scope of work. They refused to conduct a nutritional survey included in that program scope of work. And they asked the five NGOs implementing that USAID program to pull up stakes and leave.
It's such a complicated relationship from the sounds of it, and North Korea's stance in the world scene, and as you said, it's standing as a country that is just not willing to participate or negotiate, just seems to make it even harder for anything.
Chelsea, it's complicated, but also precedents that the North Korean regime could learn from. One precedent is that of Burma, Myanmar, a country that has been a military dictatorship for entry. However, they finally decided to take some steps in the right direction. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi joined the parliament. They released political prisoners in late 2011, early 2012. The international reaction was the United States sent an ambassador to Burma for the first time in 20 years. The Secretary of State visited Burma. And then after President Obama's re-election, he visited Burma as part of an Asian tour he took. So the precedent that the North Koreans can really learn from is that if they considered taking steps towards the improvement of the human rights situation in that country, that wouldn't mean that anybody is in the business of toppling that regime or in the business of regime change. These would be very logical steps leading in the direction of their joining, finally, the international community and taking some steps to improve the economic situation in that country. Unfortunately, of course, they're faced with a dilemma. Professor Victor Cha of Georgetown on this is the term of the North Korean dilemma in the early 2000s or late 1990s. Basically, in order for the regime to survive over the long run, needs to open up and reform. However, if the regime opens up, that might bring about the very collapse of the Kim family regime. So that is the Kim regime dilemma that Kim Jong-il faced. Kim Jong-un is faced with the same dilemma today.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point to end the show on. And I mean, North Korea is such a loaded topic. There's so much to talk about. So I'm sure we'd love to have you on the show again to discuss this further. I know you had a time limit and we're at that time. So I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show again. And we're going to put the website link to the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. So please go to their website to learn more about North Korea and the topics that are relevant today and for a long period of time, of course. But once again, thank you so much for coming on the show, Mr. Scarlatti. And I hope to talk to you again on this fantastic subject.
Thank you, Chelsea. I'll very much look forward to doing that.
Fantastic. We'll set that up. And thank you to our listeners, and we will provide more shows for you in the coming weeks.